I don't understand, but I don't need to. I catch a flash of movement and a branch high above me, and I throw my sword like a spear. A loud, shocked scream rocks the cavern, followed by a thud. Something lands close to me, and then it's up and moving in a flash. The sword is still in it, though, so I follow the light. I'm much taller, and in a moment, I'm upon the little beast. The creature flails desperately and catches me in the face with a cold, clammy hand. My cheek stings like I've been burned, and then all feeling in the side of my face washes away. Even so, I find my sword hilt and I push. It slides deeper in, slipping between ribs, and the creature starts to sputter and howl. Please, it whimpers, I beg mercy. Like the mercy you showed a child, I shout in its face. Close up and lit only by flickering glamour, it's simultaneously ghastly and oddly baby-like. Its face is round and red. Its eyes bulge like a strangled man's. You're a child snatcher, I hiss, a monster. I'm lost, it screeches, and alone and starving. I need a husk to hide in, same as you, Githane. We don't all have your changeling way. The trees, the children, they're all I have. For the second time tonight, I pause, and the creature seizes its chance. Its big round mouth closes over my neck, and I don't feel teeth, just suction and a sudden numbing cold. My fingers start to tingle, then my arms. I slump nervelessly to the ground, and the little red man looms over me, greedily gorging on my life. My heartbeat crashes in my ears, slow and echoing, and I feel the creature shuddering in time with it.
Welcome back to Walking Away from Arcadia. I am Simon Eichhornchen, and my co-host, Victor Kinzer, is here as well. And today, we're going to talk about the supernatural antagonists in Changeling the Dreaming.
Specifically, the ones from the Dreaming. We'll get into prodigals later.
Right. So we're going to be covering the Thelane, the Adheen, and the Shadow Court. The supernatural enemies in Changeling the Dreaming kind of run the gamut from what you could think of as true fae to corrupt changelings and to politically strange changelings.
I think it makes sense to start with the Thelane because they're the easiest to understand. The Thelane are nightmares. I mean, some of the older books talked about the Unseelie being nightmares, but that never really worked that well. And once they started adding the Thelane, which I think the first Thelane were added in the Shadow Court book, and then they sort of trickled in a new Thelane Kith here and there, usually to counterpoint with a particular Gelain Kith they were introducing. And so the types of the Thelane grew and grew. And they are really Fomorian changelings, kind of, is the way they're framed. Their early write-ups were often not that frightening. Like, they were clearly jerks. Like, Bogart's especially stand out to me as like, oh, it's a jerky business boss. I'm terrified, I guess. But then, over time, they became a lot more frightening, and in C20, the Bogarts are still kind of silly business bosses, but most of the Thelane are actually legitimately pretty terrifying. The thing that I find interesting about them is that in C20, there's this line about the evanescence happening, which changes the timeline a little bit from previous books. The evanescence is the dark glamour resurgence. It happened at 9/11, and that's when Adheen and Thalane and all other dark things from the Dreaming resurged the way that she did in 1969. And they just showed up as changelings, bonded to human souls. And they were confused, and no one knew what had happened. But doesn't that mean something? Makes you think. And I couldn't decide if there was a real idea there, or if it was hand-waving. I think there's an idea there, but I'm not certain. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, if it wasn't for House Baelor, I would call it hand-waving. But the existence of House Baelor, which is half Fomorian anyway, and that they're, at least in the canon, they're Arcadian Shi changelings, that speaks to there being an idea there. And even with the Adheen, their ability to possess humans rather than make a changeling speaks to this being a core ability of the Fae properly. It's just the Thelaine kind of lucking into being included in the changeling way doesn't sit right, and I'm hoping it's unreliable narrator, because that would clean that up a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that stands out to me about the Thelaine lucking into the changeling way is it's weird, because it takes the Thelaine out of the situation of making a choice. All the other Fae made a choice. The commoners and most of the Galain, you know, depending on how much you use the prequel material, either they had contracts and they did long drawn out rituals, or maybe they really were changelings in the traditional sense at one point and started reincarnating, depending on what lines you draw from Dark Ages Fae. But there's a very intentional development there. And then you have the whole Arcadian Autumn Shi divide, which is based again in choice, either doing the full changeling way or doing the body snatching thing and all the implications of that. And then with the Nunahi and Menahune, specifically engaging with these shamans who engage with them as some sort of adherent worshiper practitioner relationship, there's always a level of intent involved. And then the Thelaine are just like, surprise, you're bonded to a human soul. For me, the thing that makes that kind of work is that I'm not a big fan of the Fomorian as chthonic, horrible thing from beyond space and time. That's absolutely what the Fomorians are if you go all the way back to Graceful Wicked Masks. But as much as I like Graceful Wicked Masks for some concepts, like the graces and the unshaped and some of what it reveals about Fae psychology, I actually don't like the chthonic horror from out in the far wild. For me, what the Fomorians and the Thelaine represent are still human dreams. They aren't separate from humanity. They're just not. Humans have an intrinsic fear of other. They have an intrinsic fear of what goes bump in the night. And Fae have wrapped themselves up in those stories as much as any other. The fact that most of the Thelaine have a one-to-one relationship with a regular Cathane, the new Thelaine they introduced to encompass the Galain groups don't quite have that relationship, but I think that's awkward game structure. I don't think that's really intent. But the fact that there's a one-to-one relationship, by and large, says to me that maybe the Thelaine aren't that different. Maybe they aren't really different Kiths. Maybe they're, you know, part of these broad Kiths that in the days before Remembrance became muddy and before the mist wiped everything out, were coherent wholes that took part in the same kinds of contracts, and maybe the spectrum from before went much farther into darkness than the Seelie Unseelie, and humans still fear the dark. You know, for me, even that story about the Fomorians and then the in anime and then the Tuatha speaks to a story we tell ourselves of the development of human faith. Actual anthropologists would probably disagree with a lot of this, but it's a mythology we tell ourselves that in the beginning, we were just afraid of everything because it destroyed us, and so we told stories to make sense out of it. Well, those early stories would have been about our fear in its most primal form, because we were just beginning to shape names around it. Well, that makes sense that that's the Fomorians and the Thalane and their children. And then we get kind of an animus back and forth with these forces we don't understand, and that's kind of the anime, and then more structured god relationships that we have more of a back and forth relationship with. The Tuatha, not totally good, but more engaged and productive. Like, that progression still makes sense to me, and that still ties all of this to humanity. So for me, I look at the Thalane and the whole idea of the Fomorians, and I don't other them quite as much in my head. And that makes the whole, they were included in the Changeling way, make more sense to me.
And it's worth noting that the Thalane have their own special set of legacies as of C20 that are different from the ones that the Cathayn have access to. They're called Nightmare Legacies. Each Thalane has one Nightmare Legacy and then one proper Changeling Legacy. And getting a little bit back into what you just said, Victor, they justify it as, canonically, they justify it as the Thalane having been corrupted by a piece of the Tuatha dream, and that was part of the reason they were included in the Changeling way. If you give them that choice back, and you give them the agency to have chosen to become Changelings, then you get into a really interesting space with the legacies, which aren't always my favorite part of Changeling, where the Cathayn legacies are a bit more human, or recognizably human, and the Nightmare legacies are a little bit more that stuff we repress and we push out into the deep, deep parts of our subconscious and gets mirrored out into the deep, dark places in the dreaming. And that's an interesting take for this sort of a mechanic.
Yeah, and I really like that take, because for me, I want the Fae to be reflections of the least rational parts of humanity. You know, I've been mulling a lot recently on something that I saw one of the World of Darkness devs, not a Changeling dev, but one of the World of Darkness devs post on Facebook about the intrinsically conservative nature of horror in most of the canon. Canon, broad cultural sense, not World of Darkness canon. Small c conservative, and the idea that most of horror leans on fear of the other, you know, fear of some horrible demon in the darkness who's going to come for you, and that it reinforces a sense of wanting to maintain the status quo. I read that comment, I went, huh, that's interesting. It's kind of true. And I went back, and Stephen King has talked about this a lot. There are actually a fair number of articles out there on the internet that talk about this. But there's some horror that doesn't do that. The Babadook comes to mind, which is the horror in that is internal. It's human. It's really human. You spend most of the movie not realizing that, but when you finally come to understand what is happening, you're like, no, we can't maintain the status quo. The status quo is where the horror is coming from. And one of the things I realized I really like about Changeling the Dreaming is it's an intrinsically anti-status quo game. The horror is internal. The horror is you dying. The horror is the status quo. It is humanity. And so to me, to continue to engage with that, to really encompass those themes, if you bring in chthonic beyond space and time horror, which the Fomorians read on the surface, can easily become that, I think it creates some dissonance and you lose some potential synergies. If instead you say, no, the Fomorians and the Thalane and all of these dark things are humanity's fear of other. They are a toxicity, but they're a toxicity that is ultimately human. I think a lot of the quirky things that don't seem to line up suddenly sink. Like the, oh, we were included in the Changeling way. Yeah, that's because you're not so different. Don't kid yourselves. But also, you have as much relationship with humanity as anybody else, but you're the repressed, pushed aside part of that relationship, even more so than the normal Cathayn. You're the dirty part of themselves they don't want to talk about. I think it frames them in a very different, unsettling light that syncs with the rest of what the game tries to be a lot more elegantly. I think it also sets them up to be far more complete characters. as opposed to, you know, the boogeyman.
In first and second edition, the Thalane were arguably playable. I don't think I would have wanted one in my game, but they were functional. In C20, they, at least in my opinion, in C20, I don't think they took them into, like, fully, this is a valid choice for a player character territory, partly because their Nightmare Legacies are a little bit more horrific than some of the stuff that was in certain she houses.
Yeah, but, well, and they also blunted the darker she houses to make them more playable. So I think that, you know, if you look at them blunting the she houses and making the Thalane more horrific, I think that very much lines up with what they were trying to do.
The other thing is that although it's canonically possible for a Thalane to have a Seelie legacy, most Thalane have unseelie legacies as their non-nightmare legacy, which puts them into a really weird place with unseelie changelings. They are part of the reason the Seelie dislike the unseelie. They represent a darker place than most unseelie go, but at the same time, there is something recognizably unseelie in them, and likewise, the Unseelie, there's something recognizably unsettlingly dark in them, and that plays into the sort of mystical, cosmologically potent part of the courts, the part that isn't political, the part where this is part of a naming process, you know, capital N naming process, where this identity is core and doesn't change.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting that in second edition and first edition, the Thalane had two Unseelie legacies. And so when they were originally conceived and those stories were originally written, that connection was even stronger. There's also some very, there's some weirdness there because the Thalane prior to C20 were arguably super traditional. Like, they harkened back to very, very old phenomena, the terrible things in the darkness that humans have feared for millennia. And yet the Unseelie court is the court of change and progressivism. That's always gotten into some very unusual places for me. It's difficult for me to sink that in my head, which gets back to the weirdness of capital N naming that Simon mentioned. And, you know, now is as good a time as any. It kind of ties into some of what's going on with the Shadow Court as well. The King by Harry Weir Boland. Bury him then, face downward in the dust, and o'er his grave may lizards creep, may all vile spineless things which on the earth do crawl thrive on his marrow, while corroding rust eats his faint heart that knew not self to trust. And may his honeyed spirit turn to gall, may terror, which has held him in its thrall, pursue him till in deep hell he is thrust. Faith let his pathway wither, loveliness. Fair Hope's voice called him from his barren fen. Love vainly strove to lure him with her grace. His lips forever framed a thoughtless yes. When tyranny enslaved the minds of men, and courage looked on his averted face.
Part of the distrust of the Unseelie court generally among Seelie changelings comes from that overlap with the Thalane, and the biggest place they overlap and are likely to interact with the Unseelie changelings is in the Shadow Court, which, depending on your source material, is either a big joke, a thing that's part of a holiday, or a nascent darkness that's kind of infesting the changelings.
Yeah. So I think we kind of have to pick these concepts apart one at a time, and I want to get a couple of them out of the way and then circle back to the complicated capital N naming darkness dynamic. Ironically, the first sort of version of the Shadow Court that I really want to talk about is the C20 version of the Shadow Court. The C20 version of the Shadow Court is a total 180 from previous editions, which that part is fine. They did 180 on a bunch of stuff. And some of it they did 180 on because it didn't make a lot of sense. And as you'll hear in a bit, the Shadow Court in earlier editions did not necessarily make a lot of sense, so I understand it being on the 180 list. But what they did with the Shadow Court is a little odd. I'm gonna read a little segment of what's in C20, and I'm gonna jump around. This isn't a solid hunk of text, but you'll get the idea. Commoners and landless nobles banded together under the banner of the Shadow Court to make their voices heard. Rank and file members don't know if the inaction from the highest ranking Cathayne is due to malice, or if, insulated in their freeholds with a limitless supply of glamour, they're completely out of touch with the hardships faced by the average changeling. Frankly, those who count themselves among the Shadow Court don't care. Their only goal is to force a response from those capable of alleviating some of the suffering. I'm going to stop there. That's not a hunk of text I ever want associated with an antagonist. I gotta lay that on the line. In a couple sentences, they talk about how they are the inspiration for, and they in turn inspire, similar human groups such as Occupy, the Arab Spring, Black Lives Matter. And then you go down a couple paragraphs, and there is a sidebar called the Black Court. The rumors about the Shadow Court are not far from the truth. While it wasn't founded by the Thalane, it was soon taken over by them. The Thalane were invited to join the court by the Shadow Court's unseelie founders, who thought the Thalane were so few and so mindless that they would make useful, if crude, tools. The Thalane, while rare at the time, were not as stupid as the court's founders thought. They quickly recognized the Shadow Court's potential to destabilize the Cathayne. They usurped the original founders, but made sure to keep their existence hidden from the rest of the Shadow Court. They adopted the name of the Black Court in honor of their absent Fomorian masters. Today, they direct Thalane activity across the world while fracturing Cathayne society from their place atop the Shadow Court. This is throughout the rest of C20, you get more references to the nefarious Shadow Court, and it's clear from some of their references in the Unseelie She House write-ups that those writers were still referencing the dark, more evil than the Unseelie Court from previous editions, despite this write-up. There's like a fragment of a story here related to violent protesters that show up and undermine legitimate protests, but that's not the story they actually ended up telling. Knowing vaguely the work and a little bit, you know, from interactions online, a couple of the people involved in this, I don't get the feeling that the story that is told here is the one they meant to tell, but it's the one they ended up telling. I just want to throw this out there and like paint that picture for people so they know this is what's in C20. I don't have a lot more else to say about this version of the Shadow Court. Simon, I don't know if you do.
When I read the C20 version of the Shadow Court, it somehow fell out of my brain as fast as I read it, and that's kind of a feat, because the first edition write-up of the Shadow Court wasn't great either, and I still remember that.
I love the idea of this rebellious organization existing, but putting it in a structure that was intrinsically evil, leaving that structure tied to the Thalane, saying that they inspire and are inspired by these mortal groups is really awkward. I'm gonna be restrained and use that language. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, tying Black Lives Matter together with the C20 Thalane, which are very clearly supposed to be monsters, is a problem.
It is. It is a problem. I don't, yeah, like I said, I don't want to talk about this too much. I don't think there's a whole lot more to say on this topic. It's a thing that exists. There it is. The older version of the Shadow Court, the messy, screwy version of the Shadow Court that existed before, that is very much why it probably ended up on the we need to scrap this and start over pile. The Shadow Court was created by question mark. You're never quite sure how old it is. It's very wrapped up in messy remembrance. The Thalane are a major part of it. House Balor is a major part of it. There was a whole book titled Shadow Court, and it had this really fascinating opening fiction about the court, and the particular area that it's set in is run by a Seelie Shi, no big surprise. And his brother returns, and his brother is Unseelie, and they have a fight back and forth. Not a physical fight, but more an argument of words. And it's the night of Samhain. And for those who don't know, and that's also referenced in the C20 Shadow Court, that this is some of where the inspiration for the Shadow Court came from. But on Samhain, there was this big celebration, a little bit like Mardi Gras, where all the changelings let loose and just give in to their basest unseelie nature. And it was Night of Revelry, and the mists were very, very strong on the Night of Samhain, and they come in and they wipe it all away. So the unseelie who are present remember what happened, but the seelie don't remember what they did. And it's an interesting concept, and the whole point of this story was the brother, the unseelie brother, agreed to share all of his secrets with his seelie lord sibling, but he did it on Samhain, and so the mist wiped it all away. And he told this story about this organization, the Shadow Court, that he was associated with, and how they wanted to wrap themselves in banality. They wanted changelings to dig into banality and wear it as armor as a way to survive the coming long winter. It's super nihilistic on its surface. You dig into it, and it's like, oh, okay, well, this is kind of what changelings have always done. And, we've talked about that in previous episodes. And then the rest of the book, once you get past the fiction section, is Unseelie courtly love and Unseelie arts and Unseelie houses and the Thelane. And you get an occasional mention of this Shadow Court organization, despite them being the title of the book. It's basically a book about the Unseelie. I was kind of disappointed when I finished it. It's not that what's in it is bad, it's just I walked in with an expectation wanting what the title advertised, and it wasn't what I got. That same kind of wrap yourself in banality concept is invoked in the Changeling Second Ed core book for the Shadow Court, but it's never really developed anywhere else. Simon, I know you have some specific thoughts about what it represents and who's probably behind it, or at least who you want to be behind it in your stories.
A big part of that is that between the overall arc of Baelor's story and the overall arc of the changelings more generally through every version of them, you see this bend towards taking on more and more banality, which we've talked about. In Dark Ages Faith specifically, there's the seasonal court system, and there's this other group that don't really have an analog in modern changeling, the Courtless, who are generally thought of as the products of failed Sanings, but also occasionally they come into existence as actual intentional rejectors of the seasonal court system. And with the coming of the Shattering, and how there's this sudden shift where the courts aren't seasonal anymore, and suddenly they're the Seelie and Unseelie courts, there's a big shuffle of concepts that get dropped, moved around, and, like always happens in politics, when borders move, suddenly people who were on one side of a fight are suddenly allies with people who, up till that moment, they were enemies of. And then there are new people who intentionally reject the new system. It's an interesting thought that because the Thalane specifically are horrifying monsters, and that the Unseelie themselves are somewhat monstrous in a way that the Seelie aren't, that there's a new group of courtless created after the Shattering when these new courts are adopted, the Seelie and Unseelie courts. And through talking with Victor about, what is the Shadow Court? Is it a political thing? Is it some kind of a cosmological thing? And we both kind of hit on the idea that, well, maybe it was a political thing, but now it's kind of both. Especially with the resurgence and the evanescence, you have the Adheen and the Thelane both coming into the world en masse in a way they hadn't before, and they're both having troubles with it. The Adheen more than the Thelane, but both. And one of the ways they could anchor themselves more fully in the world would be to have a court, the way the other changelings do. And so there's this identity warfare going on right now for what the Shadow Court might be, especially now after the Shi have returned. There's more magic in the world, so maybe there's a way to force reality to accept a new court as a cosmological constant. And in World of Darkness, there's this ongoing theme where everybody wants to go back to the way things were, but they can't. You have to keep going forward, and that forcing things to become static is toxic. So even if, the larger changeling society realized that there might be potential to create new courts, any effort to create seasonal courts again would fail. But naming the Shadow Court into the foundation of existence could give these rejected, really, concepts from the Seelie and Unseelie Court a foothold in reality. And that's a really cool story.
Yeah, I really like that story. There are a couple other things that I think actually lend themselves to that story. So, the Nightmare Legacies. They aren't written as something that came with the Evanescence, but it's not a huge leap to say there were a handful of Thelane in the world before the Evanescence. They existed, as is evidenced by all the stories that dealt with them before. But then the Evanescence happened. And maybe the Nightmare Legacies didn't exist before 9/11. Maybe when the Evanescence happened and the world changed, more of that dark glamour surged into the world, and there had been this battle to sort of sane a new court. And to give a little bit of the prequel precursor, you were saned into a court as a new changeling. You were kind of an unshaped, chaotic thing until you joined one of the four courts or went through a flawed saning and became courtless. But even then, you are explicitly courtless. You are a thing. And so if you say the Evanescence brought all of this back and brought these Nightmare Legacies into existence and started to gel into something that maybe could have become a cosmological constant, if you draw this thread all the way back, there are some other aspects that really lend itself to that. And if you again, going back to what I said at the beginning, go back to the most powerful entity in the World of Darkness ultimately is and always will be humanity as a whole, maybe not individual humans, but certainly human consensus, and think about what was 9/11? What was that moment that changed our world? It was not supernatural. That was human. It was a deeply human moment. Everything that came after it was deeply human. And look at that origin and think of ways to engage with that when you tell stories with the Thelane, when you tell stories with the Shadow Court, and have them become reflections of the things in humanity instead of the other way around. Although there'll be a little bit of inspiration because, changelings. I think it creates a really compelling dynamic.
In that conflicted soul of the court story, there's more room for things to be really messy. The Shadow Court could still be a wing of it, this effort to bring the Seelie, mostly Shi, but Seelie, oppressors to some kind of recompense or justice, while on the other hand, you have another distinct group in there who don't care about that, and who are, House Baelor or another branch of the Fomorian family tree, who just want to end the children of the Tuatha, and they're using the court for that. And in that way, you end up with a space to tell stories that are more like what happened with Jim Jones, who was a massive civil rights agitator before he went full on evil and started his cult and killed 900-ish people.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that the Shadow Court can represent, and this is the one tiny hook into the new version of the Shadow Court, that if you told this story just right, it could be interesting, but man, you would have to tell it just right, is that people are afraid of what threatens their status quo. That, if you take out the return inspiration, if you take out the Shadow Court is inspiring these groups, and instead make the Shadow Court a reflection of the fear that those in power have of disruption, have of the rise of civil rights, have of things like the Arab Spring, and you tell a story critiquing that fear, I think that could be fascinating. It's really not what was written, but I think it has a lot of potential. I think that it also gets into the fact that, on one hand, while Changeling is a very anti-status quo game, on the other hand, it's a very established powers game. The Seelie are the good guys, so says all of the story. The Seelie are autocratic, feudal bastards. I mean, they're especially the Shi, but trolls as well, and a lot of Boggins, etc., etc. There is this, the good guys are all about order and tradition. Well, order and tradition is a source of violence for a lot of people. And so I think there's a story to be told there, but, depending on who you have at your table, that's a delicate needle to thread.
I don't think I have the chops to tell that story, but it does play into some of the themes I like to use, especially with order and tradition being damaging, because especially in this context of things getting pushed out of what it means to be fey, when the courts collapsed into the two courts from the four courts, the Seelie probably had a pretty big hand in getting the monsters pushed farther and farther out of the court system, which gets really interesting with the resurgence, and especially the Unseelie Shi coming back and pushing everything back towards the way it was when they left Earth, and reintroducing monsters into the Unseelie Court again, and making them darker than they were, and a little bit more like the Thelane, even though they didn't mean to.
Well, and that gets into some conversations we've had about the nature of the resurgence and the nature of the Seelie and the Unseelie. The commoners have some very set ideas, before about what Seelie and Unseelie meant, and they were simpler. They weren't so much high order and chaos. They were a little bit about, tradition and comfort as opposed to newness and adaptability, but they weren't really so strongly good and evil, light and dark. And then the resurgence happened. And there's an argument to be made that the resurgence really caused the evanescence, that the Shi came back and they brought all of their conceptions about what these courts meant and thinking about the control of a name as central to Fey existence. The commoners had sort of seined these concepts. They'd seined these courts and they knew what they meant. They all had both legacies, and that's fine. That's great. Go to town. And then the Shi come back and they muddy the waters. They bring back this immense amount of magic. They bring back probably naming. I mean, certainly naming in C20 is a lot more vital than it used to be. And arguably, they had a lot more capability of doing that, through the whole story of the Concordance War. And they force these courts into a different configuration to suit their vision of reality, because that's what their return was all about, trying to reshape reality into what they thought it should be, wasn't well thought out. And the Evanescence could almost be seen as an inevitable reaction to that, an inevitable swing back. You could almost lay the responsibility of the Evanescence at the Arcadian She's feet. Not that they would have any ability to be anything other than what they were. I mean, which gets to the Fae as primordial beings. How much agency do they really have? That's a question.
The steeds of the hunt began to shift as though sensing her indecision. Jaire the Younger stirred on his brother's throne, his hatred for her, for the death she'd brought his brother, and the defeat she'd brought them all, was beginning to overpower his fear of the hunt. Use us, the eyes of the Wild Hunt demanded. I am power, the horn told her, yours to wield. Jackie met the gaze of the Wild Hunt's leader without flinching from its alien depths. Dismount, she said. Come here to me. Inside her, the horn's voice exulted. You will not regret the power I can give you, it told her. But Jackie only smiled. She watched the huntsman dismount stiffly and approach her. When he was only a couple of paces away, Jackie reached out with the horn. Take it, she said. Take it. It's used to command you, isn't it? Well, take it and command yourself. What is the bargain you offer? No bargain. Please, just take it. The huntsman nodded slowly. Do you understand this thing that you do? Jackie wet her lips. Yes. Hill and moon, the huntsman whispered. To think that this day would come. He took the horn reverently from her. No! Jaire the Younger roared. You mustn't! And that's a good place to move into the Adheen, who, more than any of the other Fae groups, are primordial beings. They did not undertake the changeling way in any shape or form. They didn't do what the commoners did in joining a human. They didn't do what the Arcadian she did in stealing a body, although they retained the ability to do that for short lengths. They reside in the dreaming still, and they are quite a bit stranger than the Fae on Earth.
They are. I recently reread their write-up in detail in C20 in preparation for this episode, and for anyone who has C20 but doesn't have the old denizens of the Dreaming Book, if you really love the Adheen, get the denizens of the Dreaming Book. The write-up in C20 is occasionally contradictory, and it actually doesn't encompass why they are what they are. It sort of talks about them as children of the Tuatha and the Fomorians, and how they're, part of the Silver Ban. But it doesn't get into, even a little bit of why that happened, especially the, well, if some of them are children of the Tuatha, why would they be part of the Silver Ban? In the Denizens book, they are Fae, that when the Fomorians and the Tuatha went to war, they either sided loosely with the Fomorians, or they didn't take a side. They stayed out of the whole thing and went, I'm not getting involved in this. And when the war was settled and the Tuatha won, they even looked at their own children who refused to fight at their side, and they went, nope, we're done with you. We are done. You are cut out of the inheritance. And they made them part of the Silver Ban. And by and large, the Adheen, those that refused to take a side, they refused to take a side in large part because they didn't care so much about humanity, and they didn't care about being in the physical world, and they didn't want to have any part of this war that the Fomorians and the Tuatha were having over the realm of men. And when all was said and done, they don't really like being in the physical world. There are a couple exceptions. There are the Muses, who really have a closer connection with humanity, but most of the Adheen, or the denizens, the Adheen is actually, I recently found out, is a reference to their group. So Adheen is equivalent to like a kith or a family of Nunahi, an Adheen of Darkkin, which is a little awkward. Most people end up referring to Adheen as the big umbrella group name like Kithane or Thalane, but that's not actually how it's written in C20. Yeah, they're strange and alien, and they bubbled back up with the Evanescence. They don't have a terribly central part in the current contemporary story. They have this place in the history. They're kind of like this, meant to be this hidden, enigmatic, kind of dark, but not dark like the Thalane thing that claws its way into the world but doesn't belong there, and so there are problems when they do that. They're weird and fascinating, and I like the idea of them, but I'm not quite sure how to use them.
Yeah, I, especially reading the C20 write-up of them, I never actually finished Denizens of the Dreaming because it's an oddly constructed book, but reading the C20 write-up of them, there are lots of little bits in there that are really great. I love the Karamet as an idea. The expression of that idea in C20 isn't the way I would have gone with it. The Karamet are a group of formerly human fae who got tangled up in fairyland stuff. And for whatever reason, either they dubbed off a chimerical copy of themselves, or they died and their ghost failed to go wherever it is ghosts go, and instead stuck around in the dreaming. And the way they're written, they're a bit passionless because of what they are, which kind of flies against what the dreaming is. And you would
think
and
it also flies against what wraiths are. Wraiths are made of 189% passion. It's all they are. So that is a really odd framing, that a mixture of two deeply passionate things would result in a dispassionate entity.
Yes. And I wouldn't have as much trouble with it if they had framed it as they collect passion, because that's what they are, that's how they got tied to the dreaming. But that's not the way they did it. They're kind of zombie ghost things that just float around and lament their existence, which, not the way I would have gone with it.
I similarly really love the idea of the Karamet. I feel like they sit at the threshold of a lot of questions, and they have the potential to be really compelling narrative answers to some of those questions. The obvious one being the question that was posed in the ending fiction piece of our She episode: what happened to all those human spirits that the Arcadian She kicked out of their bodies? Well, there's an interesting question. They could easily be Karamet. Maybe that's not all the Karamet are, but there's a really compelling story to be told about bitter, angry Karamet, that maybe the Tuatha even banned wraiths in the dreaming from the Silver Paths because the Fae are often oracles, and they knew that eventually this situation would happen. And isn't that monstrous in its own special little way that, you know, the Tuatha would never be, we swear? I think that's a really interesting story. You know, Simon and I have also had conversations about kept dreamers in freeholds, where a she lord or lady will keep their dreamers and keep them enchanted forever by keeping them in the freehold and supping off their creativity. There's a really compelling human story there about what happens to artists when they really get lost in their art hole. But also, what happens if someone who has lived the last 20, 30, maybe more years of their life in a freehold dies? Are they even close enough to the normal cosmological cycles to go to the Shadowlands or transcend? Probably not. And so those are really engaging, interesting human stories where you could get some very understandable, meaty antagonists. But that's not really what was written. You kind of have to fill that negative space in yourself.
And then on the flip side, there's the Firbolg as an Adheen, who, in C20 at least, they're not really written as the Firbolg, we're the thing that came before the Tuatha. They're written as a kind of archetypical dark early humanity god thing, and their weakness requires them to accept sacrifices from humans. It's a really interesting twist to put on something in the game because all of the feeding dynamics in Changeling, they can be framed in a way that isn't explicitly offerings to a god, except for this one. And the Firbolg, especially since the name invokes European ideas and savage European ideas, it's an interesting space to go into because you avoid all of the trouble with colonialist exoticism, because this is something that, white people wrote about something that exists in a white culture. It's a little bit refreshing, to be completely honest, to have a monster be white.
That is so very valid. The other thing worth mentioning while we're talking about kind of their intrinsic natures are to talk about the courts or legacies of the Ad-Hin. They don't have sort of competing, flipping aspects of their nature the way other changelings do. They have arias. And if I recall correctly, in Denizens, there were actually separate Arya legacies, but they were a little duplicative. And so what they did in C20, which I actually like, I think it's elegant, is you pick three legacies instead of two, but they combined to make up your personality. You have a primary, a secondary, and a tertiary one, a favored. It's not primary, it's favored. And you'll always sort of lean back to the favored, but the other natures are always there and they color and inform how that primary one manifests. And certain traumatic events can send you spiraling into another aspect of your nature. And it's meant to encompass the sort of capricious, unpredictable, slightly alien nature of the Ad-Hin systematically. And capturing something like that in a system is always tricky. It's never going to be perfect, but I actually think it's a pretty elegant way to do it. Of the attempts I've seen at systematizing something like that, I like this one more than a lot of others that I've seen.
And jumping back a little bit, the Thalane have a similar thing going on. They are all their primary legacy is always their nightmare legacy, but their inactive legacy allows them a workaround for their taboos. The nightmare legacy provides a thing you can't do, just like any other legacy, except if it explicitly conflicts with something your inactive legacy demands. Then you have a choice. And even that is a little bit more interesting than the way most people play vanilla changelings.
Yeah, that's valid. That is something I like in general is I think, well, again, I'm not a big fan of nature and demeanor and legacies in general. I always feel like they're a little forced. To be fair, what came before them is the alignment system from D&D, so I can only complain so much. But that said, I think C20 did a really good job of making what is kind of a dated system feel more vital than it's felt in a long time, and using it in really innovative ways, especially with some of these darker, more alien fae, and I appreciate that.
So, where the Ad-Hin really take a step aside from the rest of the game, they don't have a feeding dynamic, at least not in C20, and I don't think either of us remember there being one in older Changeling. But that gets into a really weird territory because they wouldn't have one being in the dreaming all the time, more or less. But with the Evanescence and them coming into the real world, they would need to expend glamour while they're in the real world to power anything they're trying to do, almost anything they're trying to do. And so, how do they feed while they're in reality becomes a question.
So this also gets into some of just the dynamics with the Ad-Hin and the Thelane being a little incomplete in C20. They have, honestly, in a lot of ways, more interesting write-ups, either from a system or from a flavor standpoint, sort of different strengths in different areas than their old write-ups. But given the size, they aren't necessarily totally complete. Some of the triggering dynamics with the Thalane are a little strange, and there's some really interesting potential for development thinking about things like what does a Thalane undone look like? What sort of relationship do the Thalane have to the Dantane? And those things aren't necessarily developed. Similarly, with the Adheen and feeding and, having a little bit more of that story from Denizens, I'd really like to see all of this sort of pulled together and have a really coherent story told in a Dark Fae C20 supplement. We don't really know what the rest of the C20 line is going to look like or how much of it there's going to be, but I feel like that's something that we really do need to see at some point in this line.
Yes. That's another it's another thing to throw into the I would like a book on this topic pile.
Yeah, and there's I have a long wish list for C20, actually. I'm hoping that we see quite a few supplements in this line before everything transfers over to another new edition.
Right. And even gosh, even with the Adheen, some discussion about what happens when they take banality would be great, because they have a functional banality of more than zero but less than one, and that makes banality dynamics really different.
Yeah, and it's weird the way it's written up in C20 because you get the write-ups of how they possess or create their own bodies in the physical world. And then immediately after that, you get, oh, well, the way they take form in the world protects them from banality, so they don't have a banality trait. When they're described as being super vulnerable to banality because they're used to the dreaming and they aren't used to being exposed to it. It, in fact, is very specifically called out that when they build their own bodies, when they don't possess, those bodies decay very rapidly. They take a ton of damage. They lose a bunch of glamour. And it isn't until they return to the dreaming that they start to recover that. They basically represent their banality through their bodies being ripped apart. But then the reason they don't have a banality trait is the way they take form protects them from banality. And it's thematically a little incongruous. It's also all of this is within like three paragraphs of each other. So there's a little bit of rewiring that's necessary in the Adheen flavor section in C20.
Yeah, especially since that puts them really, really, really in line with the fair folk from Exalted. And they're not meant to be anywhere near modern Fae because reality cooled significantly to the sort of thing that the fair folk was. That they had to go through all these different iterations of first we're fair folk, then we're firstborn and inanimate, then we're changelings, and all these things are reactions to being hedged out of the world. But then you have the Adheen. What happened there? You've got the muses, which are, a mythological thing, and then you've got these other things like the Firbolg and the Keramet, who have really strong ties to the real world, or at least they did. And one way you can kind of put all these things together is to look at the Adheen like they're supposed to be the remnants of other, possibly more vital things at one point in their existence, that they're the ghosts of what the Fae who decided to not become changelings became, because anything that hid itself in the dreaming for a couple thousand years really shouldn't be identical to when it went in at this point. It's like, well,
Yeah,
gee.
Well, except for the she. And that, I mean, the whole situation with the she also brings up questions about what are the she really? Especially if you look at some of the prequel material, that's a weird question. But with the Ad-Hin specifically, I like this lens on them because they've always been a little challenging for me. In my head, when I'm just dealing directly with what was written, I think of them as, well, they didn't become changelings because they weren't connected to humanity or the physical world, and it makes sense that they stayed back in the dreaming, except, as you just pointed out, it doesn't always make sense. The Keramet kind of makes sense because they're dead and they don't belong in the physical world anymore, but the muses, there's an idea there that I think the developers were trying to get at it, the muses being removed and separate and ephemeral inspiration, but changelings already are so much inspiration. It's a weird line, but thinking of them as diminished, as reduced fae, maybe fae that didn't make it back into the dreaming in time. They were maybe caught in strands of concrete human dreams and banality and weren't able to get, to that core in the center, that Arcadia, whatever protected the she. Maybe because they didn't get there quickly enough. Maybe because they weren't noble. They weren't true Tuatha. Maybe the she are just diminished Tuatha. It's hard to say, but I like the idea of them as ephemera, as ghosts of what they were. It makes the way they manifest and their limitations make more sense to me.
And that also leaves a place for the she who refused to either leave when the shattering was happening or refused to take on a human body when they came back to be something. Maybe not the thing they were originally, and maybe not the thing they are now, but what happened to them? They died, which is a thing they're not supposed to do, really.
I like that. I know in C20 they went with this hard line, all the she who stayed behind became autumn she, and I'm not a fan of that. I like the choice. I like the agency involved in, did you choose to go through the changeling way, or did you just choose to body snatch? If you stick with that agency, then some she would have not made it to the gates before they closed and then chose to body snatch because, oh, I'm not actually going to merge with that mortal thing. That's disgusting. And in that case, if you're running with that for your, golden rule at your table, then yeah, what happens to them when they die? If some of them become Ad-Hin, if maybe that's a large source of where the Ad-Hin came from, then it opens up a really interesting possibility as the current batch of Arcadian she are dying. Are we increasing the population of Ad-Hin? Are there more of them? And I know a lot of people will say, oh no, they were associated with the Fomorians. Well, when you go back and look at Dark Ages Fae, the Fomorians are surprisingly absent, as are the Tuatha. And I am a big believer that maybe this whole Fomorian Dark Fae Thalane thing is really just about what humans are afraid of, that they dream nightmares as well. And even back in the beginning, they dreamt nightmares, as I said earlier. And there isn't anything all that different about dark glamour and light glamour, et cetera, et cetera. And through that lens, the Ad-Hin are tied up in this Fomorian story because that's the story the Fae are caught in. That's what they're trapped in. And that's what Remembrance has contorted itself into. But there's not a clean line back to history because there never is with the Fae. And I think there are some really great story hooks there as it pertains to the Arcadian she dying now.
And the Arcadian she have one really important thing in common with the Ad-Hin. The Ad-Hin interact with the mortal world either by constructing bodies or by possessing humans. They don't do it permanently the way the she do, but it's the same sort of thing.
Well, and this gets into some weirdness because fiction, but in the Changeling Anthology, they have Dragonkin Kith. And I think they were just doing it to highlight the create-a-kith concept and see how that would play out in your stories. But they very specifically highlighted the No, we went through the Changeling Way very recently, these dragonkin. And to go farther into what's in the actual crunch, book section, the Whirpeltingers are described as very recently having been Chimera. So if Chimera or dragonkin or whatever other story can eventually gain enough potence that they can become a changeling, you have to go, why can't the Ad-Hin do more solid possession? Why are they limited to these fragments of possession that really look more like being ridden by a ghost? It kind of puts them into a situation where they aren't just fae that have hung back. There's something else. There's something reduced. Because a chimera isn't protected from banality, but it can still kick around in the real world for a good long time. But the Ad-Hin can't. And so I think looking at them as wrapped in mists and remembrance and just like the definition of unreliable narrator, this idea of them as phantoms of what was, even if you don't necessarily like our particular narrative lens on it, I think it speaks to the way they behave relative to the rest of the world really nicely.
Especially with the Ad-Hin that represent a concept that may have been worshipped but isn't now. That makes a lot of sense because they sort of became divorced from the world rather than divorced themselves from the world the way that she did.
That makes a lot of sense to me, and thinking of the Fae as reduced gods, there's a difference between most of what you see from the Fae as related to actual worshipped pantheons, where a lot of people don't even know that fairies were worshipped once. Most people know fairies now in the context of what the Catholic Church turned them into, as opposed to the muses and some of the other things that appear in the Ad-Hin. Not all of them, but it does work for some of the Ad-Hin groups. They are known as, oh, that was a thing that was worshipped then. That was part of that religion. And it's interesting how a different religion can be seen as foolish by people, but the little superstition they'll still adhere to. I mean, that's well documented. So it's almost like I could imagine these Fae being things that didn't figure out the right way to wrap themselves in a story safely, and so they died off, and now there's just this memory of them out there.
And in the case of the Keramet, they're humans who died off, either in relationship to the dreaming or actually in the dreaming. And either some part of the dreaming remembered them, or some part of them dubbed off onto the dreaming. And even in their little explanation, it's not really clear whether they're ghosts or chimera. I told the nurse to give this to you after I'm gone. That means that as you read this, I'm already dead. I can't tell you to remember me, but I can't bear for you to forget me. These last few years since I became ill, I'm so sorry for what I did to you. Did to us. You've given me so much, and I haven't been able to return a single thing. That's why I want you to live for yourself now. Do what's best for you, James. James, you made me happy. Well, there you've got our extremely mixed feelings about the Thelane, the Shadow Court, and the Ad-Hin. Later, we're going to be doing an episode on the Autumn People and the Dauntain. And we're also planning on doing an episode of the Cathayne as their own worst enemies. But today we talked about the three groups that are most clearly written as supernatural enemies to changelings.
And, you know, as you can tell, there's a lot of interesting plot potential with these groups. And there was a lot done in C20 to make them a little more vital. But there's a fair bit of space that you can fill in with your own story, and the groups definitely benefit from being treated a little more like plot hooks that you flesh out into your own narrative than as a source for major canon recognition and invocation. Those are sort of the darkest corners of the dreaming.
The readings from this conversation were from One for Sorrow, Two for Joy by Nathan Dory, The King by Harry Vere Boland, Jack of Kinrowen by Charles DeLint, and Mary's Letter from Silent Hill 2. The music from this episode was Creepy Atmo by David Shizetste, Where the Demon Sleeps by Kate Covington, a remix of The Music Box by Akira Yamaoka, and LSD by Mon Plaisir. Today's poorly explained echo. If you're ever confronted by a shambling horror born from your own psyche, remember, your best defense is a brisk walking pace.